You'll get to have a chat with Dr. Sam Jones, veterinarian. Hello.
Good morning, Kate. I'm good at making up answers, aren't I?
Great. Well, you kind of know the answers. I would be just inventing
some of
answers.
Them.
It would be less useful for people, I think.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe we should sort of tit for tat and see how we go.
What have you been seeing a lot of in practice at the moment?
We've been seeing a lot of tick cases lately, Kate.
Okay.
You know, it's tick season, spring. It's warmer. There's plenty of rain and the change in, the humidity and the barometric pressure actually is what we think causes the ticks to come out and become particularly active.
Really?
Looking for food. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because we were always thinking it was sort of associated with rain, but then we're like, well, hang on, why are the ticks kind of coming out a day or so before the rain actually arrives? And so, yeah, they found that it was actually a change in barometric pressure. So we're seeing a lot of these tick cases. And there is some thought that perhaps the virulence of the tick toxin is particularly, you know, nasty this year. And I don't really know how tick toxin could evolve that quickly, but that's just what I'm hearing. You know, talking to other vets.
Tick toxin.
It's very similar.
It means a different thing for vets than it does.
It does.
I think for lots of other people. But we will talk pets. Sam Jones, veterinarian here, ready to take your call. 1300-222-612 is the number. I do want to play an early 80s or early to mid 80s song from Madonna. I really do. But Anne from Nambour is just going to jump in advance. Hello, Anne.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Anne.
Anne here, sorry. My Quaker parrot has had stringy saliva and dry retching for about 2 weeks. I took her to a vet and he couldn't ascertain anything definitive. And she seems well in herself and eating and stuff, but she's still dry retching and stringy saliva in the mornings.
That's interesting, Anne. Is she a bit of an older parrot? How old is she?
I don't know. I acquired her as a stray. She doesn't look old.
Okay. I mean, I don't know the answer to your question, but if I saw a bird that had stringy saliva, I'd be pretty concerned there was something significant going on.
She was definitely ill when it first happened. That's why I took her to the vet.
Mm.
And he tested her saliva and her feces, and was nothing definitive. But I just wondered if there was an overall thing with the stringy saliva, because my auntie's bird said she had it once.
It doesn't flag anything for me, but
right.
You know, here's the thing, Anne. You know, I only see a small number of birds, and so what you really need to do in this situation, I think it's great what your vet has done. I think is excellent, right? He or she is obviously very thorough. They're like, okay, well, we don't have an answer immediately, but let's do some testing. Try and see if we can find something, you know, in the saliva or the feces that's going to give us some direction here. But what I think you really need to do now is get a referral to, or no, I don't even think you need a referral actually. To go and see one of the actual bird specialist veterinarians. There are a few in Brisbane. Just jump online and do a quick search. And that's going to be your best chance at getting an answer and finding a cure for your little Quaker parrot.
If you have a question for Dr. Sam Jones, veterinarian, you can send a text to 0467 922 612 or call 1300 222 612.
ABC Radio, emergency information.
So just to let you know, of course, there is still an emergency level warning, leave immediately, for the pines near Millmerran. There's multiple warnings for that fire. So this warning was released at just before 9 a.m. this morning. This warning area applies to properties between Flamingo Road, Rosella Avenue, Scrubby Creek, Boondanilla Road, and to the Gore Highway as well. The situation is that fast-moving road is burning near Pine Ridge Road, and it's a leave immediately warning, which is for the pines near Millmerran. There's also so just be aware of that, and we'll have additional warnings for you at 1:15, 1:30, and 1:45 if you're listening to the radio transmitters in that area in southern Queensland. So that's for the fast-moving fire burning near Pine Ridge Road. It was at 9 a.m. this morning expected to impact the pines within the next hour. Also to let you know too, there is a prepare to leave notice too. A prepare to leave notice. This is for an area near Cairns, Mona near Cairns. There's multiple warnings for this fire as well. And a fire warning, a watch and act level warning released around 10 minutes ago for properties around Hodzik Road, Mona. Hodzik Road. There's multiple warnings for this. Visit the Queensland Fire and Emergency Services website, the current bushfires and warnings tab of their website to find out more. But a quick picture of that scenario, a slow-moving fire burning near Hodzik Road at Mona, travelling towards Hodzik Road. Conditions could get worse quickly there. If you have a bushfire survival plan, enact it now. That's a prepare to leave, a watch and act level warning. For prepare to leave for that fire at Mona near Cairns. Kate O'Toole is my name. You're on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. Dr. Sam Jones is on standby for your call if you'd like to ask a vet question. The number you need, 1300 222 612. The vet is in. Dr. Sam Jones is here.
Howdy.
And is ready to take your call, 1300 222 612, if you'd like to ask a vet-related question. John, from north of Gympie. How are you going, John?
I'm all right, thank you.
What's going on with your dog? You've got a blue heeler. What's happening?
I've got a blue heeler, Dr. Jones, and he's 8 years old.
Yep.
And he used to bark a lot in the tray, so I took him out of the tray and I put him in the twin cab. And now he squeals, and it's a high-pitched squeal, and it's sort of like you're driving in the car and he says, oh, did you see that pink elephant? Oh, there's a yellow submarine. Oh, did you see that white rabbit? And he just goes on and on and on and on.
John, are you going to do a bit of a demo for us? Like, I feel like I need you to recreate the sound.
Yeah, good call, Kate. I really need to get a feel for what's happening there, you know.
All right. Well, he
directly from John.
Okay. He doesn't go woof, woof. He goes, and it's a high-pitched squeal. And it's sort of like you got a kid in the car. And they're just sort of saying, oh, did you see that pink elephant? Oh, there's a white submarine.
It's really cute. It sounds really cute. But are you worried about it?
Well, I've almost had three head-ons when I've turned around and told him to be quiet. And I've looked back around and it's quite.
So it's actually a problem for your health, not his health, I'm getting.
Yeah. That's right. He's enjoying himself. But he's driving me crackers. And I'm the only way I can bribe him, if I give him a Menti, that's when he's quiet, see?
But whilst he's eating the Minty.
That's right.
Yeah, as soon as the Minty's gone, it's probably a different story.
All right. So
yes, it is. Once they're gone, it's all over.
So, John, he's a happy dog. There's nothing actually a problem. You're just trying to find a way for him to not annoy you. Is that it?
That's right. That's right. And I love him, and I think I've spoiled him too much, but I've heard that the blue heeler is noted for that. Is that right, Dr. Jones?
Well, they certainly can do that. They're pretty vocal dogs. The thing here is I wonder whether there has been situations in the past where he's either been in a closed space with you, let's say in a room or whatever, and he's barked and you've told him to cut it out. And so he might know that if he's in a closed space with you, that barking's not on. And yet he's aroused, right? He's seeing these pink elephants outside the car as you're whizzing past, and he wants to talk about that. And so he's have to resort to kind of like a squeal, like, oh, excitement, and that's what I think's going on, you know.
That's right. And people said to me, he's worked you out. And he has actually worked me out because I've spoiled him too much because I love him.
Yeah.
Well,
I think also the thing to be aware of here is that the Minty, you know, Minties are tasty. Dogs, I don't know how good that's going to be for his teeth. But if you do give him a Minty to try and keep him quiet, if he's crying like that, or not crying, but, you know, making that kind of howling noise, and he receives a Minty at the same time, he will put two and two together there and he'll associate, oh, okay, you know, positive reinforce.
No, it's the other way. It's not dog training, it's John training.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
So I would like to congratulate you on your John training process, John. You've been John trained.
Yeah, you've got to talk to the dog about that. Yeah, get the dog
on the
radio.
All the ABC listeners that know me, they'll think, yeah, that's right.
That's exactly right.
John, I don't have a solution. Is there any last tip that you would leave John with?
Well, I'd avoid the Minty while he's doing it. But what I would do is the moment that he stops, you know, if he's not howling, then say, good boy, and then you can give him a treat, probably something like a chicken treat or something like that might be better for his dental health. That'd be a good start.
Well, thank you very much. He eats better than the Queen's Corgis. I'll share that with you.
and has beautiful breath too, I imagine.
What's his name, John?
He has beautiful breath. You know, sometimes when we go for a walk of a morning, I'll brush my teeth and I'll put a bit of toothpaste on my finger and put it in his mouth, and he knows if there's too much there, how it's going to taste. So he throws off.
Yeah, well, don't careful with the human toothpaste. You've got to use doggy toothpaste, you know, if you brush dog's teeth, because I think the there's a constituent in the human toothpaste that's not good for them. Might be the fluoride or something.
All right, John, we better go.
On that.
All right, mate.
Thank you very much.
Good on you.
Thank you, John, with the Blue Healer that's been training John just so well. Lee and Karina, how could Dr. Sam Jones help you today?
Oh, good morning, Sam and Kate, and thank you for taking the call. This is also a noise issue, but it's an older cat and the caterwauling that is starting to drive me crackers.
Yeah, interesting one. Does she do it? Is it is girl? Is it the older cat's a girl?
So I'm not sure if it's tied up with the diet and being an older cat and
but it's
not
a female
getting what
cat,
he
is it
needs.
Lee?
It's a male cat.
Male cat. Okay. So and is he doing it throughout the day or mostly at night time?
When he's hungry. So it starts about 4:30 a.m.
Yep.
But also it might be when he can't see anybody in the house.
Mm-hmm. And is he ravenous? Is he very hungry most of the time and that sort of thing?
Yes. Hmm. Yeah.
So and have you noticed any weight loss?
The weight has come back.
Oh, okay.
A little bit.
Okay. Okay. Because I tell you what would be at the top of my list for an older cat that's making those kind of vocalizations, particularly at nighttime, but certainly, you know, early in the morning, would be hyperthyroidism. And what we see with that basically means that the level of thyroid hormone in the bloodstream is far too high. And the thyroid hormone, it has a heavy influence over metabolism. And so if we've got a thyroid hormone that's very, very high, it increases the cat's metabolism. They become very, very hungry. Often, a lot of them will lose weight. And I know that you're saying that he's gained a bit of weight, but they'll also sort of call at night time or during the day sometimes, but mostly at night time. And so he really needs he needs a physical examination and he needs a blood test, because if it is hypothyroidism, typically they'll have a very fast heart rate. It puts a lot of strain on their all of their organs, their abdominal organs, you know, and the liver can be affected. So, and it's treatable. That's the other thing. In fact, not only is it treatable, you can treat with, there's a few options. You can use sort of like a tablet, or you can use this paste that you put on their ear. And once it's under control, then you can actually have permanent treatment. You've got to send them to a particular vet clinic to get that done. And then it's done and dusted. So definitely worth looking into.
To eliminate the howling dervish problem, I will certainly follow up. Thank you so much.
No worries, Lee.
Thank you, Lee. 24 minutes past 11 on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland. Kate O'Toole's my name. A hot tip for your entertainment coming up a little later this hour. But for now, you're visiting the vet. Because, well, he's visiting you. Dr. Sam Jones is here and your call's welcome on 1300 222 612. Although there are quite a few calls, I have to say. So let's see how we go. Aaron is on the Sunshine Coast. What's your Kelpie doing, Aaron?
Yeah, I've got a 12-year-old Kelpie and he eats dirt. He'll dig a hole and have a good chomp at it.
Yep.
Seems to pick the same hole. He's taught my other 6-year-old Kelpie female to do it. And we look after our in-laws, Jack Russell, and he's taught it to do it as well.
Interesting.
Diet as well. I think we've got pretty quality food for it, giving bones.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because, you know, you can certainly get impactions, meaning a blockage in the gastrointestinal tract from eating dirt, and we really don't want that to happen. One of the things I would consider here is, do we have some sort of drainage, whether it be sewage or some other kind of drainage that is making that dirt relatively appetizing? I think you're right to point out that he needs to be on a good diet, right? You know, a premium, high quality dog food. I would be getting him onto a premium, dry, high quality dog food. You know, as you said, he's on something good already, and that's excellent. Once that's sort of sorted, I'd be thinking, okay, well, is there a drain that's draining something that's leaking out of the drain, making the dirt tasty? And if there isn't, then I would be getting him checked out because I wonder whether or not there's something physiological going on with the older Kelpie, and then that behaviour, you know, he's sharing that behaviour with the other dogs and then just doing it for behavioural reasons, not necessarily for physiological reasons. So he's an older Kelpie, right? We're always going to, well, not always, but often we find issues when we do blood tests on these older dogs. Has he had a blood test in the last sort of 6 months?
He did have one probably a few years ago before basic surgery.
Yep.
But he has done it for probably half his life.
Oh, okay.
And
Okay.
And it is in a horse paddock. I was wondering someday if it's the urine from the horse.
Could be.
But my concern is he digs these little holes and the horses, I don't want to break the leg by standing on these holes that he's dug.
Yeah, you can get ligament damage and that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
So I have asked the vet in the past, said, look, since it's habitual, he's not being sick from it, he's healthy, he's fit. So, but I'm more concerned probably if it's habitual, that's good, but I don't want the horses breaking a leg by one of these holes that he digs. So
that's really hard to manage.
A mineral I need, he's missing out on, unsure, so...
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you'd keep them separate, you know what I mean? Horse in the paddock, dog somewhere else. I remember when Digby, my dog, started digging up the yard. He was only young, and I knew I had him on a good diet, and, you know, he's healthy. He was very, very healthy. So I sensed that was curiosity, you know, young dog exploring the environment. And so I just set a booby trap for him, you know, a nice one. it was a little water balloon. I blew it with air and put some cayenne pepper in there. I buried it where he was digging, and when he dug down and this thing exploded and cayenne pepper went everywhere, then he just stopped doing it altogether because it had nothing to do with me. You know, if I was sort of saying to him, get out of it or whatever, then I have to be around to stop him from doing it. But so booby traps are good, but I don't think it's going to be practical for you in a paddock.
Yeah, no. So maybe we should go back to the vet and just get him sorted out, or?
Well, I would definitely get him checked over. I'd at the very least do a comprehensive blood test on him, you know, and the sort of thing that we might get done on ourselves if we're just either not feeling very well, or if you're, you know, over 40, haven't been to the doctor for 3 years, it's not a bad thing to go and just get a blood test and see what your health is. So I reckon it's a good idea.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Appreciate that. And all the best with the Kelpie. Craig is in Brisbane. What's your cat doing, Craig?
Oh, g'day, Sam. G'day, Kate.
Hi, Craig.
Just calling. My cat actually, he's a real biter. I think he might have a part dog in him because he chews everything. He's been chewing like cords. He doesn't chew the big electrical cords like the kettle or toaster or anything like that you plug in, but he bites the little cords. I've gone through a couple of, the iPad chargers and the iPhone chargers. He'll bite those, and he's bitten like shoelaces, and he's... He bites like my partner's slippers as well, you know, morning slippers. She gets in and he bites that. So he's a real biter, and he's I've got to put my shoes up on the top of the doors and stuff like that so I can't get them. But I'm just thinking, I've done some Googling, but I wanted to know if you know any more that I can try and sort of...
How old is he, Craig?
Coax him away from it. He's four.
He's four.
He's only just turned four.
Okay. Yeah. Well, a couple of things that pop into my head when I hear about a cat chewing on stuff. I mean... has he done it ever since he was a kitten, or has he just started doing it, did you say?
I think pretty much since I've had him. Got him when he was 1 year old.
Yeah, because a lot of young cats will chew on things, and it's a curiosity thing, but they seem to like the texture of certain things. In fact, you know, there's a well-known sort of syndrome, I guess, where cats will chew on cotton wool. Not cotton wool, you know, actually stringy wool. And it causes all sorts of issues because if they swallow it and they can kind of get a ball of wool and swallow the whole thing, it goes into their stomach and then into their intestine and can cause catastrophic damage to their intestines. So we're typically got to go in there surgically and get it out. And so, you know, it's going to be a really important thing to try to discourage him from chewing on these things, particularly electrical cords. I don't think that typically ends well. I don't know why he's doing it. If it is curiosity, maybe he's just one of those cats. And it's called pica. P-I-C-A is when animals eat in things that are inedible, typically. And so that can be behavioural. There are other reasons for doing it. And the other thing that popped into my head was dental disease, because some cats, even at 4 years of age, can have significant dental disease that may not be all that obvious to the naked eye. Cats can develop this really strange disease called feline oral resorptive lesions, where the immune system sort of attacks the tooth structures, and it can actually expose the very sensitive dentine and the nerve of the tooth, which is obviously very painful. Now, when that happens, sometimes they just need to kind of grind their teeth on something to actually relieve the pain. So I would that would be the two top things I've been thinking of. And I'd if he hasn't had a dental, I would take him to vet and say, listen, could we get his oral cavity sorted out?
Yeah, that makes me think now that you said that, because when we adopted him, on his lower lip, on his they said when we adopted him, he was hit by a car. Like, his injuries weren't not like, if you look at him, you wouldn't even think that he has been. Mm-hmm. But he has got like a bit of a, it's like a, whether it's they've sewed him up or something on his lip, on his bottom left-hand lip, or top right-hand lip, sorry.
Yeah, so well, dental x-rays will definitely pick up any sort of, you know, ongoing kind of issue there. And so I, that'll be part of any thorough dental on a cat will involve x-rays, and hopefully they'll find what's, if there is a thing, you know, what's going on.
Thank you, Craig, and all the best with your cat. And thank you for educating me about, is it P-I-C-A, Pika? Or how do you?
Yeah, P-I-C-A. That's right, yeah. Pika. Yeah.
Which, like, my immediate response is, oh, like, was the Property Investment Council of Australia the first thing. But producer Sally's like, oh, humans get Pika as well. I know that from Law and Order SVU.
Is that right, you. Sally? You know.
It's so funny.
TV watching, it can be so informative.
The human animal like disease crossover is very, very interesting. Alan in Eaton's Hill, you've got a 3-year-old dog who's maybe a bit sad.
Yeah, I think so, because we lost another pet four weeks ago, and he's sort of kind of in that period. He's probably eaten once or twice the whole meal, and he seems to leave a lot of the food behind. Is that normal?
Was he? Well, it's definitely normal for dogs that have a housemate, or you know, basically, as far as they're concerned, a sibling, another canine sibling, even if they're not from the same litter, to become depressed, you know, and sad when they lose another dog that's in their pack, if you like. Especially if there's only two of them. You know, it might be different if there's eight. But if there's only two and you've lost sort of 50% of your canine mates, that can really affect them. And there are things you can do to try and lift their mood. Certainly, I think as much love and attention from you guys is going to help. Exercise is a really important thing. You know, getting him out and about and basically trying to keep him tired so that he's not sitting around just kind of moping, you know what I mean? Now, in terms of being off his food, we never, as veterinarians, we try to be as sort of objective and scientific about things as possible. So even though it would stand to reason that he's sad and therefore not eating because he's lost his mate from home, we wouldn't just assume that. We'd say, well, look, we need to kind of rule out a physiological issue. And so let's perform a physical examination, because there's plenty of times we think it's going to be, you know, problem A, and it turns out to be problem B. I mean, he could have something else going on that just coincidentally, you know, at the same time, whether it be something painful in his abdomen or whatever. And so I would do a thorough physical exam. And again, I'd do a blood test because I want to know what's going on with him physiologically. I can't look at his liver. I can't look at his kidneys. And so the blood test helps us. I rule out those types of issues that could be going on concurrently, you know?
Okay.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
All the best. Just on that issue, though, of exercise, I mean, when humans exercise, it gives them
endorphins,
like good hormone feelings. Yeah. Does it do the same thing animals?
It does. We know it does. It's great for, you know, our mental health. It's really good for the mental health of our dogs as well. It's so important for them too. And not just the exercise itself is excellent, but it's also, you know, it represents significant stimulation for them. We're often leaving the house and going to work or whatever, and we've got the freedom to do so.
Mm.
But, you know, a dog that's sort of stuck at home, I mean, they've exhausted all of the stimulation, you know, within the four corners of their house. And so it's really important for them to get out and sniff other things and do all that sort of environmental enrichment stuff.
Yeah, like life in lockdown. We had that experience you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I can't really leave the house and you have to, you know. Yeah, so, yeah, that
crazy
idea of going out is important. A few messages coming in on the text line. I'll ask a few of those in a moment. But just one quickly about tags in dogs. I'm thinking they're talking about skin tags. This person's saying, I'd love to hear a conversation about tags. Some are like almost like big pimples and others are big solid lumps. They don't seem to bother my dog, but I'd like to have them removed. Is that recommended?
Yeah.
What sort of procedures would you go about?
This is actually an excellent question because we see it a lot. People will come into the clinic for a vaccine or something and then they'll sort of say to me casually, oh, yeah, and, you know, he's got this lump on his ear or whatever. It's been there for about 6 months, but, you know, we're not worried about it. Or they might say, oh, the previous vet sort of, you know, if they've come from another clinic, they might say the previous vet said it's probably nothing to worry about. Now, it is virtually impossible to look at a mass, whether it be a skin mass on the skin or under the skin, and say definitively that that is not anything to worry about, right? At the very least, we need to put a needle into it, take out some cells, squirt those onto a slide, stain that slide up and look at it under the microscope to try and gain some idea of what that is before we make a call about whether or not it's dangerous. Now, sure, there are some skin masses. There's some certain characteristics of skin masses which would suggest that they are malignant, such as, you know, ulceration, fast growing, those sorts of things that, you know, are suggestive that it's a malignant mass. But just because we're not seeing those things.
And we say a malignant mass, nasty. You're talking about like as in big cancerous. Problem happening quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, malignant meaning, you know, nasty, cancerous, you've got to get that thing off as soon as possible, could spread via the bloodstream, that sort of thing. So in terms of skin tags, you know, which let's just define a skin tag as being, you know, a sort of tag of skin, a little lump that's hanging off the skin, right? Now, they look fairly, you know, innocuous, don't they? But I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I had a vet nurse a few years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, and her dog was in, it was a Shar Pei, and we were doing a dental on the Shar Pei, and she said, oh, he's got this little skin tag. You know, again, it was a case of the previous vet. She said, before she worked for us, she said, oh, the previous vet said, probably just a skin tag, nothing to worry about. And I said, oh, well, I mean, it looks like a skin tag, but I said, well, we won't really know unless we do some cytology. That is when you suck out the cells.
Looking at cells, yeah.
So we did that. We put a needle in, we put it on a slide, we looked at it, and lo and behold, I could see quite clearly under the microscope mast cells. Now, so this was, by definition, a mast cell tumour, okay? Looked like a skin tag, but it was a mast cell tumour. And that tumour, they are nasty, or they can be very nasty, but they need to come off straight away. So we removed it at the same time that we sent off that sample, that excisional mass to the lab for them to tell us, you know, how nasty it was, because you get different grades of mast cell tumours. And so that's the thing. The lesson here is you don't know unless you do the diagnostics. You know, you've got to do the testing to try to ascertain what it is. And the absolute best test for a definitive diagnosis is to remove, either get a biopsy of it, so part of the tissue, and send that to the lab, or take the whole thing, an excisional biopsy, and send that off to the lab. And then you know for sure
what it is. It's tough, though, because everything that you're saying sounds also expensive. And so sometimes on balance, it's like a balance of probabilities thing, isn't it? Where you can make a decision as a pet owner that you're like, well, in this instance, this is a risk that I'm going to take for XYZ reason.
That's right. I mean, that is why, you know, I'm such a big advocate of pet insurance, because it takes that element out of the decision making. It enables you to offer best medicine to your pet, you know, provided you can afford the pet insurance, right? But it means that, okay, we're stressing about this. It could be cancerous. Maybe it's not. We don't really know. And you don't want to also at the same time be stressing about affordability. So if you can get your pet insured, then that takes that component out, and you can make decisions that are in the best interest of the pet without anything other influences.
On ABC Radio Brisbane, Kate O'Toole's my name. Dr. Sam Jones is his name. He's a vet. He's in and Doreen on the Sunshine Coast. You're worried about fleas on your cat, or at least wanting to make sure that your cat is free from them. But what's your question?
My question is, it's quite a simple one. And what I'd like to know is there some kind of product that does not smell as dreadful as the flea worm tablets, drops do? Because when I put it on the back of my cat's neck, she's an adopted one, by the way. Mm. She can't tolerate it. She goes berserk, and she will run for cover, quick as flash. And then most of it goes on me.
Yeah, yeah.
Then
defeats
of course, whenever I go near her, she won't have anything to do with me. She runs away again because of the smell. Is there one that could help?
The answer is probably, I won't be able to go through an exhaustive list of all the products on the market, but what I think it's going to be, and I can do that after the show, that's fine, Doreen, I can give you a quick list of things, but I think it's going to be a case of trial and error, because I suspect that some cats are more sensitive to certain products than others. Therefore, whatever you're using now, it's okay, well, let's not use that one, you cross that off the list, let's try a different product, and see how that goes, you know. And she might tolerate it more. And then you just pick the one that she's less worried about, you know what I mean? Yeah. So there'll be a few products on the market that you could use to try and achieve what you're trying to achieve.
Two. And obviously, you know, being a rescue cat, she obviously hadn't been through this before. But to be honest, I mean, the one that I've been using it smells absolutely dreadful. It doesn't surprise me.
We might have to do a bit of trial and error, Doreen, to try to find a better solution. Unfortunately, there's not a definitive, here's the definite one that is, you know, smells beautiful and will be enjoyable for everybody. But thank you so much for your question. And it is difficult when you have, when you adopt a pet who's used to a different pattern of behaviour, used to tolerating different things and having to adopt and not wanting to bruise your relationship. So I understand that too. John in Birkdale had the question. We have a kitten growing into a cat, visiting our yard, carrying off lizards and birds with tragic regularity, despite having a little bell. And so John, I gather, wants to create a cat-free zone in his yard, because it's not his cat anyway, and asks, are cat repellents effective?
Well, I guess the thing for me is, you know, being a veterinarian, we are trying to encourage as many cats to come to us as possible. So I don't actually know that much about repellents. I did a quick Google search because I saw your message there, John. I thought, okay, well, what's on the market? Yeah, there's a lot of natural ones out there, as it turns out. And I was interested to read here that pipe tobacco was in the list. But anyway, fresh orange and lemon peels seem to come up a fair bit. I don't know what that looks like, you know, going around the whole yard.
Sprinkling them around the yard, yeah.
Certainly, but the thing is, citronella, like, you know, we know that cats and dogs don't like citronella. That could be pretty effective.
Yes.
If you were to spray that around the yard. You know, lemongrass, what else they got here? Eucalyptus. So, in short, I don't know how effective it's going to be, but I think, again, it's probably going to be a case of trial and error. And if you had the time and energy, you could get, you know, a bit of all of it. And that's natural too, those things. You can get these other things that emit sort of, I think it must be sound waves or something. But
John, though, is hoping to encourage like native wildlife in his yard. Don't you also run into a problem where if you're trying to dissuade cats, you might also dissuade other things? I guess maybe lizards aren't sensitive to the same stuff. I'm just thinking about in talkback gardening when they're trying to dissuade possums and things, that it's also that kind of smelly stuff where they're like, oh yeah, they don't like this.
Maybe. I don't know whether they're mutually exclusive. I was just thinking what popped into my head as well. You could get an owl. This would probably dissuade native wildlife, but you could get one of those owls. And I bet you, because cats are predators. They don't, they want to feel secure. They know what it's like to be an attacker and to be attacked. And if you had a kind of a grim, nasty looking owl, portrait or whatever. That could work.
Yeah, maybe. Rod in Townsville, just a quick one. How long is it safe for a dog to hold on for, as in to go without a wee? Is it like, is 12 hours plus, is that a problem?
Well, if we're talking about safety or we're talking about sort of comfort, I don't know. In terms of safety, there's probably no real, I mean, they're going to pass urine once their bladder gets so full that they can't hold it anymore, right? Unless they've got a problem. And I guess maybe that, I'm not sure the context of the question, because, you know, maybe if he's concerned that his dog has had a blockage of the urinary tract, you know, and you're like, oh, geez, it's been 12 hours. I would have thought he'd urinate. There must be something wrong. So I think certainly, you know, you want to be able to give your dog the opportunity to urinate at least every 8 hours, but certainly a lot of people are out of the house for 12 hours a day. And I guess a lot of those dogs are in the backyard, but if they're not, 12 hours would be my upper limit. And I think also maybe the smaller dogs might need to go out more frequently. Certainly younger dogs, absolutely, more frequently. I know that my dog can hold it for 12 hours, no problems. He's a 38 kilo Labrador, and he doesn't have an issue. But in terms of, when do we start to get concerned that dog hasn't urinated? Well, I think I would base my concern on what the dog is doing. If they're relaxed and they haven't urinated, I'm not worried. If they're licking their nether regions and whatnot, and they look distressed, concerned, then I would act promptly.
Thank you for the question, Rod. Thank you for all your calls and texts. And thank you very much, Dr. Sam Jones, for stopping by today. You saw one other text. There's others that we haven't got to. But, okay, go on.
Can we?
Quickly.
Good one, yes. What have we got here? Oh, Rachel and Hazel have written in. Hi, Dr. Jones. I've read that I can use human hemorrhoid cream on my dog's bum. That's cute.
Right.
When his anal glands get smelly and fishy. Ew. Is that true? Great text. No, that's not true. We actually do use hemorrhoid cream, but not for the purpose in vet science. Well, I do anyway. For the purpose of aiding healing in those wounds that are we just need the skin to kind of close over and grow. Mm-hmm. Across. It's got zinc in it, and it helps the skin, encourages the skin to grow across. But it certainly won't help with the anal glands because they're not on the outside; they're on the inside of the anus, and you got to squeeze them to get it to get rid of the fluid out of there.
Yeah.
Good question.
Sorry, Rachel and Hazel. Sorry that's not a good and easy solution. It's 14 minutes to midday. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Dr. Sam Jones. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Kate.